This episode of Tales from the Lot is sponsored by ShakedownT-Shirts.com with unique lot style t-shirts, license plate frames, coffee mugs, and all sorts of things for Grateful Dead, Fish, Zappa, Panic, and more. ShakedownT-Shirts.com, where all U.S. orders over $35 ship free. And just for Tales from the Lot listeners, use the code LOT20 for 20% off of any order. That's LOT20. Hey, real quick, before we kick off this episode of Tales from the Lot, I've got some exciting news to share with you. I've been working on a project called Summer Tour The Game, inspired by our love of following our favorite bands around. It's a tabletop board game where you chase shows, collect ticket stubs, and relive the magic of live music, all from your own tabletop. I'm thrilled to announce that the Kickstarter campaign for Summer Tour The Game is launching on May 12th. If you're a fan of this podcast, then I think you're really going to enjoy this game. You can check out a short video and all the details at summertourthegame.com. So whether you're a seasoned road warrior or a tabletop gaming enthusiast or just looking for a new way to connect with friends, I invite you to check out the campaign and consider supporting it. Every pledge and share and word of encouragement makes a difference. I'd love it if you would help spread the word and make Summer Tour The Game a reality. Thank you, everyone, for listening and being a part of this journey, and now on with the episode. Tales from the Lot, episode 24, When is the Next Tour? My guest is Robert Ingersoll. He's here to talk Seeing the Dead in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. Nim Chimpsky and the Project Nim documentary and much more. Here we go. Welcome to Tales from the Lot. This is Will. My guest this week is deadhead, activist, and all-around awesome person. He's coming from San Francisco. It's Bob Ingersoll. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, thanks, Will. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and tell my stories from the lot.
You're in San Francisco, but that's not where you're from originally, right? Where are you from, born and raised at?
No, I'm actually from Boston, and my dad was in the military, so we did a lot of travel, international as well as, you know, we've lived in a bunch of states, Florida, North Carolina, New Jersey, Massachusetts a couple of times, and Oklahoma. And then when I turned 18, I got drafted. So I, instead of going into the Army, I joined the Air Force, and one thing led to another. And when I got out of the military, I had met a girl from Oklahoma. So I moved to Oklahoma in 1975 to go to undergraduate school. Mm-hmm. And pretty much the first day of school, I met a guy that was teaching sign language to chimpanzees, which turns out to be Washoe, the first signing chimp. And so I was pretty enamored with that, as you know. And
it couldn't be. I mean, this is a fantastic thing. I mean, to be able to communicate.
It really turned out to be not something that I really knew where it was going. But as soon as I met him, first day of class, I walked up to him after class and I asked him, hey, can I work with you? And at that point, he wasn't as internationally hugely famous like he ended up a few years later. So he allowed me to meet the chimps. And a couple of days later, I met a couple of chimpanzees named Allie and Vanessa. And I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon. And like everybody goes to college, they want to be a doctor or a lawyer, right? And I was 22 years old at the time. And so I went out to meet these chimps. And the moment I interacted with those two chimps, it was like, wow, I don't know what this is called, but this is what I want to do. And, I mean, I knew that chimps were my people, in the weirdest kind of way. I wasn't really an animal person or any of that sort of thing, but, there was something about those two chimps. And then as it turns out, chimps in general that I had some, I don't know. I don't want to call it magic, but I understood them. They understood me, and we got along well. And although chimpanzees are they are very dangerous and nothing to mess around with. But for some reason, I knew how to handle chimps. And so for a couple of years, from 75 to 77, I worked with a bunch of different chimps. And then in September of 1977, I met Nim Chimpsky, who is a sign language chimp that's, you know, pretty famous now. There's a movie and a bunch of books and stuff. Will's seen the movie, actually. Yes. And I became like the movie says, one of Nim's or Nim's best friend. At the same time, in September of 1977, I knew about the dad. I had Working Man's Dead and, you know, American Beauty and all the albums, but I'd never seen a show, you know. So, and I think every deadhead out there that, you know, when they went to their first show, it was like something in their brain clicked, just kind of like the Chimps did for me. And I went to my first show in October of 77 at the Lloyd Noble Center. I think it's one of the Dick's Picks, actually. It might be number three, but it's the Lloyd Noble Center show in October of 1977. Actually, it's, I have it written down here. It's the 11th of October, 77. Mm-hmm. And at that show, I was like most people that go to their first Dead show. I was like, holy cow, this is way not the album. And it's a
bit of a culture shock, too.
Yeah, indeed. And and it's 1977. I don't think the Dead were played any better in any year than 1977. So I walked out of there with my molecules rearranged, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I was pretty focused on the work I was doing with the Chimps. And so from afar, I knew some deadheads, but I met more, started trading tapes between 77 and 81 or so, when I went to my second Dead show at the Zoo Amphitheater, and I think it was 81. Yeah, 81. And and then again, had my molecules rearranged. I think it was the last Dead show that wasn't sold out. And it was a magical experience. And it was kind of like knowing that I was a chimp. Mm-hmm. I knew I was a deadhead at that point, right? And so still pretty occupied with undergraduate school and graduate school. So again, next year, 82, and then 85, saw the next two Dead shows at the Zoo Amphitheater. And then in 85, unfortunately, the Chimps that I worked with had been sold to medical research, which you saw in the movie. And I was kind of lost, looking for somewhere to plug in. And I know a lot of you deadheads out there, when you went to your first parking lot or went to your first show, the community speaks to you, not just the band itself or the music, but there's something about the whole community that is attractive, especially when you're looking for a family or some family, you know, connection. And in the 85, we started touring, and I learned how to tie dye, because you have to have money to be able to tour, you know. Yeah. And that was before everybody in the parking lot was selling something. So a friend of mine named Sean O'Brien, we went on our first tour and went to Alpine Valley, went to Minneapolis, did St. Louis, a bunch of shows, and sold tie-dye, the Rosemont Horizon, and met incredible people. Met photographers, you know, had come up to us. My friend Sean was like Dread at the time, and so his dreads were like major. And you know, this lady walked up to us and said, "Hey, man, you are so interesting looking. Can I take your picture?" And we ended up letting her do it. And then she sent us, you know, photographs back. And and it was just a fun thing to do. At the same time, because my chimp friends were sold to medical research, I was also doing newspaper articles and trying to get in magazines and on television and stuff to promote the plight of the signing chimp, because Nim Chimpsky is pretty famous. And so 60 Minutes and a bunch of people, like, you know, shows like that, national interest in his plight. And so when we went on tour, we also handed out information about the Chimps. So we had fun in the parking lot selling tie-dyes and stuff. More importantly, we're handing out information about my chimp friends.
Right.
So, and that went on until about 1988, when I met who would become my wife, Belle, who's sitting right here. And in 1988, we were doing a medieval show, a medieval fair, and selling tie-dye and handing out information about the Dead. And, I mean, about the chimps. And of course, we were talking about, by then we had been on tour. And so all of our friends were deadheads and we were trading tapes and all of that. And,
right, yeah.
and meeting older deadheads than me. I'm kind of old, but there were at the time, shaman that had tapes and knew, had all these connections and actually indeed, yeah. knew the band and things like that. I did see the evolution at times. I saw Brent turn into Bruce Hornsby. Actually, Hornsby was, there might've been some, I don't know exactly what was going on, but Hornsby showed up a couple of times when Brent was still in the band before he died. And so I witnessed that transition. And although it was, I mean, of course it's not Pigpen, you know, cause literally the Grateful Dead, as I read historically now, I know all this stuff. It was his band. I mean, even yeah. Jerry thought it was Pigpen's band. And I get it. I've heard all those tapes. I hear the complete difference in the way the Dead are after Pig and before, you know, when he was in the band. It was just a different band. But the nucleus of what the Dead became when Jerry kind of, without taking over, took over. Cause I really think that Bob Weir's, as like Jerry says, was an insanely great front man. I mean, he did really yes. well. And I don't think that, and I don't know if I'm pretty sure that Pig and Bob got along, but I don't think there could have been the Grateful Dead after Pigpen without someone who was as powerful as Pigpen in terms of being a front man. Right. And I, you know, I got to say, I think Bob Weir is freaking amazing. I mean, I've seen over 150 shows and, you know, I never walked out of there going, oh, that sucked. I never want to come back. You know?
No.
I mean, there might've been some shows that were, you know, shaky, but there was always right. one or two songs that are like, whoa, man, that Morning Dew was amazing or whatever, always. You know? So, so for me, I get that, but I mean, it's going on now. People are like, oh no, I hate Dead and Company. I'm like, yeah, I've seen about 25 Dead and Company shows. I'm going to the Sphere, and I'm looking forward to it. I mean, and I see the differences, you know, I appreciate those. I hear the tapes. I've got every one of the, you know, Dave's picks, and I've got 3,000 hours of cassette tapes and all that. But really it's the music. And the interpretation of the music, I think, is up to the musicians. I'm not a musician, you know what I mean? Right. And I want to give them that leeway. They're evolving and they're older. And so, I mean, I understand that sentiment that, screw them. I don't, like, you know, I mean, it's not something that a lot of my friends and I don't talk about. I mean, but my friends, we still go to the shows. You know, right. and we still have a blast. I mean, we saw the Dead and Company shows at the Gorge here recently, and then here in San Francisco, what, five shows, I think, five or six. And man, the energy was there. It was, well, you can watch the films and the clips on YouTube. That San Francisco show was amazing. I mean, and it really, you know, I guess that's a personal taste or whatever, but I don't want to live in the past, although I loved it. It was great. Jerry was, you know, Jerry. I mean, what can you say? I mean, I have Jerry stories, you know, crazy ones, you know, in 19, what was it, Bill? 93, 92, something like that, in the Boston Garden. We, we were slightly altered
happy.
And happy. And after the show, I mean, we're like,
we were blown away.
We were, and the show was so good. We were literally blown away. The Boston Garden empties out. It's just me and Belle. And we had moved over and sat down in some seats behind the stage to kind of, you know, because we had to get back to my aunt and uncle's house, which meant going out and getting on a trolley to the Green Line to the Red. I'm from Boston, so I know my way around. And, right. and, but we were like, well, man, that's going to be a hassle. And so we sat there, you know, trying to bring our molecules back together. And then a sliding curtain opens up And then Jerry walks out and there's nobody in the place except Belle and I and Jerry. And both Belle and I were like, Jerry, like that. And he looks up and he smiles like from ear to ear and waves. He's got the briefcase too. So we're like tripping, you know. Well, literally and figuratively. And and he waves, doesn't say a word, smiles, carefully walks down the steps and goes out. And Belle and I just looked at each other and goes, wow, that was cool. That kind of stuff. You know, it's those kind of moments. And I know everybody that's on your show, at least, and more so than even some of the stories we have that are like that. They're like the moments that are part of your life that you reminisce back to, and it all kind of fits together. You know what I mean? So,
a lot of people talk about it as like that their life is this line, and then they go to a Grateful Dead show and suddenly it's going this way. Like there's right. that point, and everybody can mark that point where their life changed. you know, we all know when that happened, what song we was would, playing or whatever moment it was.
Right. And then after you get home from tour, all you can think about is getting on the Grateful Dead hotline. And when is the next tour? When does it start? When do we send in our mail order and all that? Mm-hmm. It was something to look forward to. You know, you come back to the grind, you do what you got to do. You know, I mean, and I hear this from, I'm into Billy Strings right now. And so and the Billy Strings scene is very reminiscent of the Grateful Dead scene in terms of the energy and the love of the scene and the music and all that from the fans, the young fans and yep. people like us, we pick up on the similarities between what's going on with Billy and what went on with the Dead, because it's very similar because it's about the music, you know, and I think yeah. that Billy appreciates that. And we loved touring and going to multiple, you know, our friends, our family and some of our friends would be like, dude, you've seen them like 85 times. I mean, why do you do that? And it's hard to explain to someone that has only been to one show or whatever, right. that no, it's different every night. And then yeah. the peripheral experiences around the show itself are different. And then of course, after a few years, you know, people that you've met on tour that you can't wait to see again. Yeah. And that has happened to us over. I still have friends that I met on tour that are still my yeah. friends that aren't in my regular circle of friends living in my town or anything. But
definitely
when
there's nothing I've looked forward to more than the start of tour, the anticipation for knowing that I'm about to go see 10 shows in a row or whatever,
that
feeling at that time, nothing greater than that I've seen.
I totally agree. And we would, we cherish that because every now and again, you'd walk into a show and from beginning to end, it would be like, oh my God, you know? Mm-hmm. And some of those Alpine Valley shows in the mid 80s, 84, 5, 6, 7, 8, 89. I went to all of those and got magnificent seats. I was on the third row once at them. Back in the day, you could bring your actual camera into a show. And I had a bunch of nice camera equipment. It was a little older, you know, so I had a nice Canon camera with big lenses and stuff. So I on the third row, I'm like, you can see Jerry like looking at you, his eyebrows moving and shit, you know, it was like the audience was part of the band and the band say this. And so I'm sitting there blissing and I had a big lens and I put it on my camera and pulled it up and Jerry looked at me and in the middle of the song, he shakes his head no. And so I'm like, oh, I've disappointed Jerry. Damn it. And so I put the camera down. I took the big lens off because you could take it off and put the smaller lens on, you know, quickly. And then I lifted it back up with the small lens and Jerry goes like this. And then he poses, you know, he's like, and it's those kind of moments. And I know you probably heard a million stories like that, but it was that the camaraderie between the audience and the band, the understanding of the nuances of what's going on stage. And, I don't know. I say it in the film, actually, it was, except for Nim, the best times of our lives were at Dead shows and in the parking lot and like at the laundromat in Akron, Ohio, right? Because during that Akron show, at the Rubber Bowl, during that tour, it rained a lot and our clothes were, oh God, it was a mess. And my friend Sean and I were camping, right? So we went to a laundromat like on the day off in Akron and ran into a couple of like three old ladies that were in doing their laundry, right? And we looked like deadheads, right? Long hair, dread, you know, crazy clothes, Guatemala pants, all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Skateboards. And these ladies were like, nicely, they were very polite and really nice. They're like, what do you got? Why are you here? And told them all about the Dead and the Rubber Bowl where the Dead were playing. These ladies were like, oh, let us help you do your laundry, you know? And it was like, we met old ladies in Akron that had nothing to do with the Dead that got, you know, got some pleasure from seeing us having a good time out like in America. You know what I mean? We're from Oklahoma. I mean, that's where our home bases were at the time. And it was the pure joy of that kind of interaction, you know, and it didn't have to be other deadheads or anything, but just nice people, you know, and when you're nice to people, they're nice back to you, you know? So it was, you know, those were good times. Although that wasn't a really great show. That was the Tom Petty opens and Dylan is, you know, in Tom Petty's band or whatever. And, I don't know. I just personally back in those days, I was way more into just the Dead and didn't need to have an opening band or any of that. And some of those, we went to the, you know, we went to shows like the Rainforest Benefit in New York City, but I just myself personally, I just prefer straight up two or three set Dead show, like a New Year's show or whatever. But, but those were anomalies, you know, those shows with Tom Petty and all that. Plus,
I didn't see a lot of those, but I did see one where Sting was the opener. Was his band was really good. I'm a Vinnie Colaiuta drummer fan. And
did you see the one in Vegas?
No. Which one? That tour?
Sting show with the Dead.
No, I saw him like Buckeye Lake and Soldier Field.
Oh, yeah. I didn't see the Soldier Field, but we went to Buckeye Lake a couple of times. We might have skipped the skim, you know, because we're in the parking lot selling tie-dye, right? So sometimes we wouldn't necessarily go in early or whatever. But we did see them in Vegas a couple of times with, who was that? Santana? No, Steve Winwood, I believe.
One of those. Yeah.
That was another one of those parking lot scenes after the show. Yes. A lot of people are, you know, not exactly all together after a show. It's like, whoa, where are we? And I had a Volkswagen van like a lot of my friends and the pop top, you know, I was like, I fit the stereotypical deadhead, you know, stickers on the back of the car. We got pulled over several times by the police and
I was so paranoid then.
Man, I can tell you, in South Carolina, we had an interesting interaction. We were going, actually, I gave a talk at the International Primate Protection League, and then we were going to Atlanta, you know, because we planned it. We're like, oh, we'll go to IPPL and give the talk, and then we'll drive to Atlanta and see the Dead shows. Well, in South Carolina, I drive in the van, and it's got, like, all kinds of stickers on the back, mostly Dead. And, cop car state trooper comes up and around us and, you know, surveys us. And then we come over a hill and there's two more and then they come and, you know, of course they pull us over and my taillight was out. That was their excuse. And it was out. It was, but I had a bulb. So I said, well, I've got an extra bulb, but they're like, by then they're like, no, we're going to search your car. And I had bunches of stuff, our clothes and stuff. Cause by that time we weren't selling tie-dye. Bell and I were just more touring and, the fact business, the International Primary Protection League talk about NIM and this and that. And, and they went through all the bags, threw all this stuff out, you know, and pulled my pants down, looking in the waistband. And Belle's a court reporter. So she's like, you can't do this. And they're like, hey, we got the guns and the badges. We can do whatever we want. Fortunately, we had no drugs. They could find nothing to bust us for. And they ultimately let us go. We went to the first rest area, pulled over. I fixed the taillight Then we went to the shows, which were fabulous, 3 days. But it was a little unnerving, you know. So those kind of things. And I'm sure lots of people had even worse experiences than that, you know. So that was minor, relatively speaking. But in Vegas, that in the parking lot, I went out to my van and wouldn't start. And I knew what was wrong. The coil was messing up. And so I couldn't really think. We had like five people with us and I had some, we sold bumper stickers and a bunch of other things like that. So I had all the people in the van get in the driveway to the, to the Silver Bowl, you know, people going out. And so selling stickers at the same time, identifying the Volkswagen vans that were going out and going, "Hey man, you got a coil for a 88 van?" And lo and behold, I mean, I knew this would happen because I'd been on tour for 8 or 9 years by then. I knew there were some resourceful deadheads out there that were driving really old buses and stuff. And this one dude pulls over and goes, "Yeah, man, I got like 8 of them." You know, and so we went through that. And it was so cool because he stopped, pulled over, helped me install it. And it was a two-prong instead of a three-prong coil. But the third prong was just the ground. And so we just plugged up the hot and the cold to the coil and it worked. And so I'm like, "Hey man, how much?" Cause they're usually like 60, 80 bucks, right? He said, catch me some other time. And it was that's the kind of thing that drew us to keep on coming back, you know, because we met so many great people in Minneapolis. We met a couple of people that we hadn't had a shower in like 4 days. And it was like 10 in the morning. And they're like, "Hey, you guys, we live right around the corner. You want to come to our house and take a shower?" And we're like, "Really?" We went That's to awesome. These people's houses and took a shower. We've stayed at Daryl and Rose. We met these people in Alpine, actually. And a couple of years later, we ran into them and we were in Washington, D.C., and they invited us to stay at their house for the couple of shows. And they were like serious deadheads like we were, you know. It were those kind of events that really kept us going.
Attention all concert lovers. Are you tired of missing out on your favorite shows? Because tickets sell out faster than a studio version guitar solo? Say hello to the ultimate solution, the Truckin' Ticket Membership. With the Truckin' Ticket Membership, you'll gain access to the hottest concerts across the country, guaranteed. For just $1,500 a year, you'll enjoy the freedom to choose any 10 concerts you want, in any U.S. city, at any venue, no questions asked. Mix and match cities and artists to create your dream concert lineup. You want Dead & Company at the Sphere? Cypress Hill at Red Rocks? Willie Nelson at the Ryman Theater in Nashville? With the Truckin' Ticket membership, it's no problem. But wait, there's more. Upgrade to our special two-ticket Best Friends package for just $2,500 a year and bring your concert buddy along for the ride. Because music is always better when shared with a friend. And for the ultimate concert experience, don't miss our exclusive 25-concert Jam Solo package. For $10,000 a year, you'll receive not only guaranteed tickets to 25 concerts of your choice, but also airfare, hotel accommodations, and rides to and from the venue, making every concert an unforgettable adventure. So why settle for FOMO when you can be in the front row at every show? Join the Truckin' Ticket membership today and elevate your concert-going experience this year.
So we just had a fabulous time. I mean, I took my mom to a show at Bayfront Center in 1988 at the Bayfront Center in St. Petersburg. And the show I took her to, the last song was Morning Dew. And the spotlight came, and I believe this is on YouTube. You can watch the whole show. And Jerry did one of those tear-jerking morning dews with the spotlight just on him. And I turned and looked at my mom, tears rolling down her face, you know, and she's wearing a tie-dye dress, and she'd helped me sell dye all day, went off and walked around in the parking lot, came back with Dead Base 2, you know, because I told her, yeah, they've got this book out there. It's called Dead Base, and it has all the songs, you know, because so, you know, my mom was interested in what the hell I was doing, you know, when I was 20, whatever years old. And so when I went and took a break while she was, I came back with a Grateful Dead California shirt that had a frog on it. My mom collected frogs. My mom wore that shirt all the time. When I'd visit, people come up and go, your mom wears that Grateful Dead shirt all the time. She's the hit around here, you know. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing that you can. I took cousins and friends, you know, that never experienced it. You know, one of my cousins, we're at the show at the Boston Garden, and she's like, first of all, they hadn't even turned the lights out, and people are like reefing up, you know, and the whole place is smoke filled, and she's like, the governor's here. What is going on? There's a governor of Massachusetts. Tom's a deadhead, you know, and so the Kennedys are all deadheads, and I'm like, yeah, it's kind of a different world. My cousin's name is Marty, and we had fabulous seats, and she has those ticket stubs framed in her house on a Boston Garden poster. And next to where it says, you know, all the things that go on at the Garden, they have the Grateful Dead on that poster. And so she has her tickets attached right to the Grateful Dead. It's, you know, those kind of things. But mostly for us, anyway, was the music, you know, and the love of the music that could make you smile and have dance like you just can't not dance, and or have emotional reactions so deep that at the first note of a song it just brings tears to your eyes, like Morning Dew, for example.
Stella Blue for me.
I could not describe it any more accurately than a cultural phenomenon that I'm glad that we participated in, because we look back and went, we skipped that. We didn't do the Dead, or, you know, and I have a lot of friends of mine that said, you know, hey, you want to come to the Dead? I got some extra. Oh no, next time, you know, now when I see those same people or here in the last 15 years since Jerry's been gone or so, they're like, man, I wish I would have went to that show. Like,
I've had some friends like that at the time weren't real into it. And were reluctant to go. They were doing other things. They were doing life things. And then just have recently come back and said, oh, you know, we should have went with you because we've recently discovered just how good this music is.
Right. And now everybody's like, it's like on television shows and everybody, you know, talking about how everybody was a deadhead, you know, and all this, you know? So yeah, it's something that I'm really glad that we didn't miss out on. We had a great time. Like this shirt, for example, is a shirt that a friend of ours in Oklahoma did. Her name was Ann, and this is a Bonner Springs. What's the Sand Springs in Kansas, June 24th and 25th, 1991. I've seen Mickey with this shirt on playing at another show. So, and I believe sent, you know, obviously a bootleg shirt, but pretty damn good bootleg. And
that's a great shirt.
It glows in the dark. So it was that awesome. That culture
that's
that,
great.
You know, and artists and other musicians that appreciated all of the Dead, you know, because you go to a show, you're going to hear other people playing in the parking lot before and after. And if
that's
it's
what
like
I miss
Alpine,
so much.
What's that?
That's what I miss. That's what I miss so much. Is the drum circles mainly like that? I mean, just being able to walk through and hear different ones coming in, like at the beginning of that Infrared Roses album, for instance, where it's like somebody walking through the lot and you hear like trucking coming out of somebody's van and the drum circle starts happening. And then the guy that walks by your ear and says, Doses, you know, like all of that stuff.
Indeed.
It was a moment in time and a place.
The parking lot scenes now are kind of out of so huge, and not quite as well. I don't know. I guess when we were going to shows that until the end, when it got a little nutty and there was, you know, like in Orlando, there were so many people showed up to the show that they were trying to get tear gas and, you know, and so, so there's good and bad to that. Too many people into the, you know, and you were around at the end.
Yeah,
you
I was at Deer Creek when they broke down the wall and saw the, you know, what.
Yeah, we were at those shows. We actually, our last shows were in, weren't they? Those shows, the ones that were in
before they went.
Yeah, right before the last shows before Chicago.
Yes. That was that was the last ones.
Friends of ours had extra tickets to Chicago, and we could have gone, but it just, there was some foreboding or something in the air, and we weren't feeling it, you know, and Jerry looked terrible. And so we declined. I mean, and now sometimes we're like, oh, we should have went to those shows. And I'm like, nah, I don't think so.
It was just so hard, that tour.
That tour was very difficult. Amongst our Deadhead friends, it was almost as if, I can remember conversations like, is he going to die right on stage? Yeah. You know, that kind of thing. So it was difficult to see and watch because we loved that guy, you know? Yeah. And I think a lot of us wished we could have said something or done something. But as Steve Parrish and all the close dead people say, there was nothing we could do. I mean, we tried, you know, but you couldn't. Plus, I don't know. I've been, you know, I've had my times with drugs. You know, it it can grab you, and if you're not, you know, able to step back and take a deep breath and, you know, go, I don't want to die here. It could be difficult. It's just imagine if Jerry was still alive today.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it is what it is, and the history of it all is what it is now, and. I'm just glad we participated and had so much damn fun because that was, you know, Jerry said it. I'm out here to have a good time, you know, and fun is the name of the game. And he certainly did give us an opportunity to have a lot of fun. And nice, I'm most grateful to him, the band, all the ticket people, you know, that we sent our envelopes to get our tickets, the roadies, all those. A few years ago, Bonham's, an auction house here in town, did Ramrod's estate sale and sold one of Jerry's Travis Bean guitars that sold for like $400,000 and a bunch of other stuff. And Ramrod's mandolin was in that sale. And you can imagine that Jerry had played that mandolin, right? And the estimate was pretty low, and at the time my wife has a good job and we have, you know, ample amount of money, and and so we're sitting there and she goes, go ahead, bid. So I'm bidding on Ramrod's mandolin, just bidding is cool, you know, because we're in a room full of people that are bidding for $200,000 items and stuff, you know, and and I got to like $850 and the guy goes, hits the hammer and I win. I'm like, whoa, holy cow. Wow. So we have Ramrod's mandolin and you know, and of course, hundreds of posters. And as you probably know, I owned a Grateful Dead store during that time that Two Guys Tie Dyes turned into a store called Jungle Gems. And we sold Grateful Dead merchandise stuff. And
was it officially licensed?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We dealt with the band. Nice. So, we got all the band related stuff, posters and this and that, shirts and all that Liquid Blue stuff. By that time, Liquid Blue, by the early 90s, they had pretty much, you know, we met those Liquid Blue guys in like 85 or 86 at the Rosemont Horizon when they were first starting. And I traded something to them for there's a Rainforest Action Network, Panther, tie dye that they had, one of their first shirts. I still have it actually. And that evolved because their stuff is quality. It evolved
and iconic.
Yeah, really. And so we sold all that stuff. We didn't sell drug imagery, no pot leaves or any of that stuff, no pipes. And it was like a dead show, a dead store with Guatemala stuff and African stuff, but none of that because, you know, behind the scenes, as you've seen the film, so you know what we were all about. Right. We also sponsored the David Gann's Grateful Dead Hour for 3 or 4 years. So we kind of indoctrinated Oklahomans into the Grateful Dead. I still have friends that come up to me in Oklahoma and go, "Oh my God, I miss Jungle Jim's and your, the Dead Hour and all that." And I'm like, "Well, you know, I don't really miss retail, but some of those things I miss." Yeah. And then they're like, "Whoa, dude, we've got tapes. We've got your commercial." And I'm like, "Yeah, so do I," because I was a taper at the time. So,
yeah.
But we incorporated our, you know, our fun life, the Grateful Dead touring and the music and all of that into the activism. And mm-hmm. I mean, I liked Grateful Dead stuff, the shirts and all of that. And, yeah, and no what doubt. Better way to get somebody to come in and listen to what you've got to say about saving chimps and the chimpanzees that I worked with at the university. And, you know, we played the Grateful Dead in there, and we always had great bootlegs and stuff. So people come in to just to chit chat, you know, just to come in and talk, you know. And
right.
You mentioned Infrared Roses. We got that when it came out and played it in the store. That is some trippy stuff.
Yeah.
So we actually sold some music in there as well. So and we saw Widespread Panic and Dark Star Orchestra and, you know, several other bands, things. And had my employees talk about our activism, because during that period of time was when I was actually at the Black Beauty Ranch, which you saw in the right. film, and right. and some of that stuff, the stuff that was at the Black Beauty Ranch. My wife, Belle, here, she shot most of that, like the scene where Nim is very pushing cool. that barrel around. That was Belle yeah. on camera. And I mean, we rolled in there not knowing what was going to happen. And I handed her my stereo video camera, Sony video camera that, you know, they'd gotten nice by 91 or 92. Mm-hmm. And I showed her how to work it real quick. And as we were driving down the driveway, that van in the, that you see the little, mm-hmm.
The Jerry
the
sticker.
Wheel sticker and yeah. Jerry face of Jerry. That was my van. I mean, the movie is
I assumed. You
know, out of sync a little bit, but yeah. I handed it to her and said, "Hey, film until they tell you to stop. And then when they tell you to stop, keep filming, you know, when yeah. they walk away." And fortunately, they just let us film. And you see where I met Nim for the first time right. and he runs back and forth. And then we're both like, "Whoa, is that, you know?" And then, you know, it was like an old friends. So,
the name of the film, it's Project Nim.
Yeah, that's it.
I gave it a viewing, and it's amazing. It's a little bit sad. It's a little bit funny. It's definitely enlightening. I can't say enough. I recommend it to anybody, to definitely view this, and the work that you do in it, you definitely see the relationship between you. There's a few people that have a relationship with Nim, before you come along. And then when you come along, you can see the difference, and it's like Han and Chewie or something. I don't know, but the way it really came across a difference. And, you know, documentaries are made however they're made, and the viewpoint is whoever's making the documentary, obviously. But you could definitely see that there was a connection between you two specifically.
Well, I appreciate that. I do think that we'd been approached a lot by other people to do, you know, films and documentaries about my relationship with Nim. But we resisted that for a long time. And then a woman named Elizabeth Hess came along and wrote a book called Project Nim. And I participated in that. Well, first of all, I like Elizabeth, and I knew that she was going to do a good job. And I knew she was going to write the book anyway. And so I wanted to participate. And then shortly after the book came out, and I believe, 2008, I believe, is when the book came out. And very shortly after that, Academy Award winning producer named Simon Chin from the UK, who did Man on Wire and Searching for Sugar Man, amongst other things. Extraordinarily talented producer and really awesome dude. We're like friends now. Actually, mm-hmm. a about 2.5 years ago, we were in London to see to do a book release. I've just recently written a couple of books, and the first book, we were doing a book release party, and we made it so that Billy String shows and the book stuff happened at the same time. Coincidentally,
very nice. Yes,
not really, but we went to a Billy show, and I contacted Simon. I'm like, hey, Simon, we got some extra tickets. You want to come? So Simon came and saw Billy, and he even said, hey, what label is he on? And I'm like, he's on Warner. I think he goes, oh, I've got a deal with Warner. So, you know, who knows? But he loved very Billy. Cool. And, but more importantly, back to Project NIMH, he had done Man on Wire. So, and before it had won an Academy Award, they contacted us about doing Project NIMH. And so I said, well, I don't know. What about James Marsh, who's the director? And he did Theory of Everything and Man on Wire. So we went to see Man on Wire like a couple of weeks or a month or so before it won the Academy Award. And Belle and I were like, these guys want to make a movie about, yeah, we, you know, so they're extremely talented, and we knew that they were the guys. And then we, you know, we sort of negotiated. It was more like a handshake, friendly conversation. And I knew they were, you know, I'm like, you guys are going to be the one. I'm actually, James Marsh has been in the set right here while we negotiated the deal. And it's a, I think, is it Rotten Tomatoes? Is that what it's called? Rotten Tomatoes, yeah. The hot, some yeah. 17th best documentary of all time, apparently. So, and I get letters and emails from all over the world. Once got a, emails from Iran, from young female students at the University of Tehran that said to me, you know, well, you're our hero. And I'm like, oh, please stop. You're my hero, ladies. You're going to school. You're going to university in Iran, passing around a bootleg copy of Project NIMH amongst their animal rights group in Tehran, risking their lives to be able to view a film. So it's that sort of thing that gives you that kind, you know, because I do mention the dead in the film, you know, and I do some lyrics kind of just came out of my brain at the right moment. I, not that I practiced, but Belle and I, we talked about, you know, what possibly was going to be asked and how I would, you know, do the interviews. And I, a lot of my friends are like, man, you're a natural. And I just think that I've lived it. It's authentic. Like now I don't have script or anything. We're just having a conversation, but I've lived all of this stuff enough to be able to express it in the way that I think people understand. And when
there's
you
a
see
passion
film,
for something.
Yeah, indeed. And I think that that passion is the same sort of passion. Cause I think that's what, the way I say it in the film, I say, well, you know, I think it's like word for word. I mean, I don't know. I'm a deadhead, and I think I might rather hang out with NIMH than Jerry. And for me, that's saying something, you know. And that and that's like, you know, that's having two things that huge in your life that feels like it's that important to you. I feel really blessed and very lucky to have been able to have that in my life and still pursue it. I mean, we still see, like I said, Dead and Company, and we go to Sweetwater up in Marin to Bobby's club and saw Molly Tuttle there, seen Bobby there a couple of times, and still, you know, we still participate in, you know, Reed Mathis is a friend. And, when I had Jungle Gems, we brought David Nelson Band to Norman. I'm like sitting in my house in Oklahoma, which I still own the house. David Nelson's sitting in my house, and I've got albums that I bought when I was 17 years old of the New Riders. It's like, whoa, this is so surreal. I can't, so much so that I forgot to get him to sign the albums, you know, but it was one of those things that even Nelson and Barry Celeste and the band, they understood my trip, you know. Barry, actually, I showed him like 3.5 hours of some of the footage that you saw on Project NIMH from the Oklahoma days. I showed all that to him. So it's something that you can see the passion when in what's more like love, actually, to be honest with you. I mean, and when you see love on film like that, it's not it's not hard to recognize. And I think that, like I said, those students in Tehran and many hundreds of people that have written to me over the years, you know, asking me, how do I get to be you? And I'm like, well, you have to find something you love and pursue it, and don't take no for an answer, and do the best you can to keep your chin up even when things are down, because believe me, there were a lot of not so fun times. I mean, I wasn't always a movie star, you know what I mean? so, you know, I had to do some things that were not pleasant. I mean, I handed out flyers on our campus one time and got thrown down by the cops and my flyers taken away and that sort of thing. But that doesn't happen now. Now they invite me to give talks and show the film at the art museum and this and that. But it's that persistence, because I think you're willing to do a little bit more than you would normally when you know you're doing the right thing and pursuing positive and goals that are pure. And and that's the other thing about the Grateful Dead. That's pure. And I think at the root, you know, of course, there are all kinds of terrible stories about getting busted and this and that. But at the root of it all is love and understanding and music and getting along and all the things that you can't really put your finger on, but you can feel it. You know, you feel it at the show. When free hugs, for example, you know, I mean, what better way to express, you know, that sentiment than when you see a sign? I remember the first time I saw one of those signs, free hugs. I'm like, whoa, dude, that is perfect. You know, so it's that community that I respond to. And I hope that other people will, you know, even if you don't necessarily think that Dead and Company is as good as the Dead or the Jerry Band or whatever, that there's at the root of all that is the Grateful Dead. And I hope I have as good a time at the Sphere as I've ever had at any show. I had at the Giants, the baseball field this year for Dead and Company, the final tour or whatever, and up in at the Gorge. It feels the same, you know. Yeah. It's different, but it's the same.
Same so, family.
Same
family.
Yeah, indeed. And you know what? You see all these young kids that say things like, "Well, what was it like to see Jerry?" You know, and it's
was better.
Yeah, it was better.
How did you say it was better without just saying it was better?
Well, the reality is that, thank goodness, those kids can get on YouTube and watch full shows and understand what was the root of what is happening now. And although you weren't there, you can still, it ripples out. Exactly. And you can still experience it. I mean, you buy a 100 inch screen TV like we got going on here and throw in the Grateful Dead movie. You know, I mean, it's a wonderful time to be a Deadhead, to be perfectly honest with you. David Lemieux is absolutely phenomenal. I have all of those discs. It's a thriving community and it's evolved. I mean, unfortunately, we've lost a few along the way and that's just the way families are. That happens. You know, it's an encapsulation of life itself, you know, and I love seeing Bobby still carrying on and doing as many shows as he does. He could have retired years ago. I mean,
he does a lot of shows.
He really does. I mean, and he inspired, like I said, I'm into Billy Strings. I see the inspiration that Billy gets from Bobby and the ultra respect that Billy pays. You know, Bobby went to Billy's wedding a couple of months ago and played at the wedding, you know, and Billy talks about that in an interview, like with ultra reverence, you know, so. And for the kid, Billy is a kid, 30 something years old, to be able to play with his heroes. You know, it's a cool thing. And I feel lucky to have lived during this period of time where Jerry and Bob Dylan and all the band, Frank Zappa and all the bands that I got to see, Muddy Waters, all that stuff, the background for all of this. I mean, Bell and I have been lucky. We go to as many shows as we can and we mix it up. I mean, we went to see Madonna here a couple of years ago. We went to the Taylor Swift shows in Los Angeles. We didn't pay a lot of money, but we got in the lottery. But I tell you, those kids that go to that show, they might not be deadheads, but they've got that same kind of passion for Taylor and Taylor's music and Taylor's message that we kind of have. And so even though I don't, I couldn't name one Taylor song, I'm glad I went. And it's a different cultural experience, but it is indeed something that those young kids can reach out to and find some a space, you know, that they can identify with. And it's different, but you know what? It's not a competition. Music's not a competition. It's about what you like. I mean, I'm telling you, I saw literally hundreds and hundreds of people singing. I looked around and I'm like, it was everybody was singing along. They knew every word. And you gotta respect that. And and you see that they're like turned to their moms crying, you know. So it's you know, like I said, I think that music isn't a competition, and it's about I mean, and Taylor can play, you know, she can write songs. It might not be what, you know, necessarily our cup of tea, but she definitely has got something going on. But you know, like I said, I got the lucky. I got to see, you know, see bands that, you know, Clapton with Freddie King and all that in the 70s, you know.
You mentioned Zappa. Like, what? I'm a massive Zappa fan. Like, what era of Zappa were you seeing Zappa?
Oh, I saw Zappa in the 70s and into the, you know, in towards the end. But, God, when was that Zappa show? It was probably around 78 or so.
Like Terry Bozzio.
He was at the height of his powers. I mean, his band was like that giant band. I saw him like three different times. I got lucky when I was 14, my best friend's older brother was into Zappa. So he had those early, you know, like the Mothers. Only In It for the Money and all those early albums.
That's the best one.
And schooled us little kids on Zappa, you know, and when you listen to that stuff, you appreciate the genius of, because every single thing that goes on a Zappa record is written down on a piece of paper. It's like, whoa, he was super phenomenal. I mean, we saw Little Feat on New Year's Eve in 1979 with Lowell George and Bonnie Raitt. I mean, I've hung out with R.L. Burnside, and the North Mississippi All-Stars and all that during that time that I had the Grateful Dead store, because that kind of opened the doors for me to be able to have a connection to promoters and this and that. And so I just feel very lucky, because music is at the key to all that. We have friends that are musicians that have helped us out along the way. The Brian Haas, who is Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey. He has done a number of promotions for us and several local Oklahoma musicians Mike Hosty and other folks that play in the Oklahoma City area that have helped us out along the way with the Chimp stuff and artists. So, and you know, and at the same time, you can turn them onto the Dead. I gotta say that I bet the first time that, or the first time that he was really immersed in the Grateful Dead, Reed Mathis, who now plays with, you know, almost all the people in the Bay Area that are related with the Dead. He actually plays a lot of Dead, and we went to a show recently where most of the songs were Dead stuff. So, and I think that he might have first really been immersed.
Yeah, he was in Billy and the Kid.
Immersed in the Grateful Dead music in my store. So, and he was the bass player in Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey during that period of time. Phenomenal. If you're not familiar with Reed Mathis, yeah, become familiar. He's a fabulous musician. Do you know him?
I know the name, but I'm not familiar.
Yeah, he's a, first of all, he's a great guy and a fabulous musician. He's a, I believe he was a concert trained cellist, and his interpretations of Hendrix and all kinds of stuff. he, like I said, he was a bass player, but recently he's been playing six string. And we saw him recently with some of the guys from the Animal Liberation Orchestra, the Lebo, I believe is his name. So, I mean, obviously we're into the Dead, but we, like Jerry said, you know, music, go out and see people. He did bluegrass. I mean, you know, he did jazz.
Yeah. Well, you know, he would play with like with the new writers. He'd play a set and then he'd, you know, and then play like three sets with the Dead and then then go home and practice banjo or something after that, you know?
No, indeed. And fortunately, I got to actually speak to David Nelson about all those days, you know, how was it to, you know, I said something like, what was it like to like play with Jerry and this and that? And he says, dude, I had to go on after Miles Davis. And I'm like, whoa, I never even thought about it like that. He said, yeah, I was the most nervous person on the planet. It was like Miles Davis opens for the New Riders. I'm like, holy cow. You know, so and Bill Graham has a lot to do with all of that. I mean, yeah. He paired together lots of different bands that wouldn't normally go together. Speaking of Bill Graham, in 1988, we were at the New Year shows, my friend Sean and I, and we had the flu or something, and we had the back door of my van open at Pop Top. And back then, the little scooters weren't something that everybody had. And all of a sudden, this scooter pulls up behind our van and sticks his head in and goes, hey, you guys, what's going on? And we look up, and it's Bill Graham. And we're like, we're sitting there drinking tea or whatever, and we're like tripping. We're like, Bill, how you know, it's like he shakes our hand. He's super nice and asks us if we need anything. I'm like, this is the promoter of this is Bill Graham, for God's sakes, you know, being that cordial and that polite and nice. And we offered him a cup of tea. He's like, no, it's all good. It was that kind of a scene that, mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard a lot of stories about Bill Graham, this and that, but my experience with Bill Graham was super awesome.
And, I've heard some of those hard ass stories.
Yeah. He was like kind of into the money or whatever, apparently. Yeah. But, you know, I get it because I promoted shows and, you know, promoting shows is no fun. But fortunately for me, I, you know, we made money and then all the profits we gave back to the bands. We, you know, like I said, we did New Riders and we did, not New Riders, David Nelson Band. And we did Guitar Shorty once or twice and the Swag, which is a band based in Missouri that's like a Dead cover band. So we tried to expose as many people as we could to what we were doing and worked that chimp activism into the whole scene because it just made sense to me that, well, if I'm into these two things that much, I can blend them together in a way that seems, and it was authentic because I'm really this guy. You know, but when you see the film, even I, when I see the film, and I've seen it hundreds of times now because, you know, it's played around and I've done lots of film festivals and screenings and this and that. We went to Edinburgh and Toronto Film Festival, Boston, you know, all kinds of places, Belle and I. Mm-hmm. And we sit there and go, whoa, it's such a trip to see yourself on a big screen, you know, so But it helped, and it helped our chimp friends. Things are not perfect, but they're better. And most of the chimps in the United States, not all, but most are in sanctuaries now or zoos, which, you know, I'm not a big fan of zoos, but it is what it is. And they get treated with respect, and they're not used as pincushions in medical labs anymore, and that's not been going on for quite some time.
Yeah,
so I still helped to run away. A monkey sanctuary in Oklahoma called the Oklahoma Primate Sanctuary, which we started during the time before the movie and all that when we were running the store because I had a little extra money and we could do that. It's now over 30 years old. We have 120 something monkeys. I'm on the board of directors of an animal sanctuary called Oliver and Friends in Oklahoma as well. So I you know, and they're Deadheads, actually, the founders, you know, Jenny and Jason. So, you know, I walk into their house, they got Dylan posters and, you know, and they're into the Dead as well. So
that's great.
And like most people, what's that?
Really messed up animals there.
We take in cows with three legs and stuff like that. We get prosthetic legs made for them and stuff. We do the hard cases. But it's that passion, you know, and deadheads, if it isn't, you know, if you can't say anything about them, you can definitely say that they're passionate about what they're into. And, and it carries across into their lives. Jerry said it himself. He's like, man, you never know, you know, doctors, lawyers, mayors, governors, you know,
vice presidents. Jimmy,
what's that?
Vice presidents.
Yeah. Vice presidents. Al Gore. Yeah. Indeed. So it's something that we all can kind of glom onto and respect one another in a way, you know, that, you know, we don't have to hate each other. You know, love is a lot better than hate, you know, be kind all the time, all that. I mean, I'll never forget the first time I saw Be Kind bumper stickers. It was like, whoa, how cool is this?
Yeah.
I mean, we toured.
What a simple, great idea.
Yeah, indeed. It's like, you know, be kind all the time. We toured during the time when Nelson Mandela was still in jail. So we gave away abolish apartheid stickers and this and that. So besides the music, you can bring a little bit of that social justice and environmental justice and racial and, you know, all the kind of things that we hope to solve, you know, and getting along is a lot better than not getting along, you know, and finding some common ground and working from there. Cause I when you talk to somebody, instead of yelling at them or writing nasty messages to them or people that you don't even know, that's not helpful. And, I hope that, you know, and Bobby and the band now, Dead and Company, they're involved in getting out the vote and, making, you know, getting involved in your life because this is our life. So, I can't tell you how much fun we've had here in San Francisco in the last 18 years. I don't know. I can't even tell you how many times we've been to the Fillmore or to the Great American Music Hall or to the Orpheum. Is that the name of that place?
Yeah.
The Orpheum or Bobby's place or the Warfield or Phil's Club before it closed, you know, and actually running into, you know, like Phil, you know, who is an awesome gentleman. You know, I've gotten to sign. He put out a book a couple of years ago. I went and, you know, of course, stood in line and got to meet Phil. We met Bobby a couple of times.
Was that Searching for the Sound?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right.
I loved that book. That was one of all the Dead books. That was one of that one and Mickey Hart's book were like my favorites.
Yeah. I also like, there's another one by one of the roadies. I forget which one it is, but it's pretty good too. You know, and everyone has their own perspective. We run into Steve Parrish a number of times and Mountain Girl and also Donna. Because, you know, they do a lot of benefits around here. So we're like, yeah, let's go to that benefit. I'm just glad to be able to speak to you about all this and hope that those people out there that are going to shows, you know, show all the kindness and I'd be perfectly honest with you. I've always had good times at music events. And like I said, the Billy String scene is very similar. And there's a lot of crossover. You meet a lot of deadheads that were like, you know, with, talk dead we're in the line wait for posters or whatever. So, and the music is inspiring and, joyful, you know?
You said that you have a book out or coming out.
I do have a book out. Actually, one of the books I have right here is our first book, which is called Primatology, Ethics and Trauma, the Oklahoma Chimp Studies. They're academic books, but there's a lot in here that is not academic necessarily. So we approach this from an academic perspective. And the next book is coming out very soon. This one you can get on Amazon or from our publisher, Routledge, which is Routledge. Routledge is a publishing company, an academic publishing company in the UK. Our next book, I believe, is up for pre-sale maybe on Amazon, and it's called Trauma in Sentient Beings, the Nature Nurture NIM, and it's coming out, I think, in June. And this is actually a picture of me on the cover, And that's me right there, or wherever, right there. And that's
you're the less furry one.
Yeah. Duh. And that's Washoe right there, who is the first signing chimp. And we're sitting there signing. That's the sign for what? So I'm going, what? And she's about to sign, you know, what she wants, which I might have something under my foot or whatever. And the next book has a picture of me, being groomed. It's the next book has a color picture on the cover, and it's got a picture of Nim and I, and he had accidentally scratched me, like right here on the side of my face. And as soon as he did it, and so the picture is him about to groom my face to make sure I'm okay. It's really, you've seen the film, so you know that there's some remarkable footage in that film. And even if you're not into any of this stuff, if you just see the 10 or 15 minutes of footage in the film, that's Nim and I interacting, you'll have a different opinion about the relationship that you can have with another animal, and maybe even change your mind about, you know, how animals, you know, interact with the world. I wasn't always a vegan or vegetarian, but over the years I've come to realize that animals are just like us, you know, and especially chimps. And since I got a chance to work with chimps, it has been very eye-opening. I mean, I gave a talk in like 1983 or 84 at a elementary school called Little Axe, outside of Norman, Oklahoma. And after the talk, this kid came up to me and he said, "Mr. Ingersoll, do you eat meat?" And I was like, "Man, come on," you know, because it was about lunchtime and I hadn't really thought about it like that. And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, how do you expect me to believe anything you say about chimps if you don't care about cows and pigs and goats?" And at that moment, I realized, well, you know, if I'm going to be this guy that's going to, you know, talk about animals and protecting animals and being kind to animals, I can't eat the other animals, you know. And I didn't have anything for this kid, you know. So I said, "What do your parents do?" You know, and his dad was a doctor, his mom was a college professor or something. But it was like that kid was asking me some of the really, you know, important questions for me to be able to figure out before I would become this guy that's sitting right here. I mean, I'm not telling anybody to do anything in their lives, but if you, you have to do what you have to do about all that. I'm vegan, but I'm not going to browbeat you about it. But when you see that footage of me and Nim interacting, it's pretty damn eye opening, I think. And I think that you'll agree, Will, that it's powerful. And now that I work with farm animals, I've even had my eyes opened about that sort of thing. You know,
I was going to ask you, does that change your relationship in the cognitive or communicative skills of other animals?
You know, I'm not as good at it. I mean, I can deal with apes for, you know, chimps and now orangs. I've worked with orangs a little bit. And now that I've been around Jason and Jenny, their relationship with these animals is remarkable. And, you know, you've seen the footage of like ducks that once they get to know their owner, they come up and hug and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing I've witnessed. And we have animals that, like I said, that are in dire situations. Three-legged cow that we built. I say we in the executive, I'm a board member, but I don't do the work. And I gotta say, it's the volunteers at our sanctuary the farm animal sanctuary, Oliver and friends, that do all the hard stuff, and mostly Jenny and Jason. And you see the appreciation of the animals because they know they're getting helped by humans. Mm-hmm. And I can stand back and just see the same sort of thing you see with Nim and I in their relationships. At the monkey sanctuary, what we do is we take animals mostly from labs now. We have some pets, ex-pets, which we don't recommend. Do not get a monkey for a pet. It's a bad idea. And we'll end up being involved in the equation. We really don't want to rescue another pet. We'd rather work on the ones that are in labs right now. And what we do is we integrate lab monkeys into groups of other monkeys, and we try to let them be monkeys as best we can. Sometimes we have to teach them, or we have to show them other monkeys that have gone through the same thing. So it's very fulfilling work, I gotta say. But sometimes it's hard. And one of the things about Grateful Dead tour back then, even, because we've been running that monkey sanctuary for over 30 years, it was like, woo, I get to decompress a little bit and just let the air out, you know, and go and, you know, I mean, Belle and I attended some shows at Shoreline. Actually, when we first got together, we were at a Shoreline show, I believe, in 91, right? In 91. And we were like we were at the Boston Garden. We were a little bit, you know, like, whoa. And at the break, we couldn't get up. We're like, no, I don't think I'm going to walk right now. We're all good. And I'm kind of, I don't sound like it, but I'm kind of shy when it comes to, like, I liked Belle, but I wasn't able to figure out how to say that to her, you know, because I thought she was out of my league. And so during that break, I turned to her and I don't know, it just popped out. I'm like, I want to kiss you. And she looked at me like, what? You know, and I said, yeah. And she said, well, you know, maybe not now, not right now. But I said, well, how about a rain check? And a couple of days later, we went to Yosemite and that, you know, and then we camped there, and I looked down the camper vans, and you've probably been in one. There's a bed up on the top and a bed on the bottom. And in the morning, I looked down and said, hey, how about that rain check? So she said, okay. And we kissed one time, and then that was it. We were together. I mean, we were adults, so, you know, nothing really happened except a kiss. And then that day we were driving through the, you know, we got up and, you know, rustled up our campground and this and that, and driving into Yosemite for the first time for me, it was just a couple of days after the Shoreline run. And, the sign on the ranger station where you pay to get in, it had a sign, a chalkboard, and there were Grateful Dead bears drawn on there in chalk. And then it says, have a grateful day, you know, and it's that kind of, that's one of the things about the Grateful Dead, that it's like a secret little society. And people that didn't know about the Grateful Dead had no idea what that meant. But when we pulled up there, we busted out laughing. I took a picture of it because it was so cool, and still have it somewhere. I mean, that's the kind of thing that Tales from the Lot. That's what this is all about. You know, it's those kind of experiences that, and I'm sure other people listening went, oh yeah, I remember that. You know, it's the beauty, the camaraderie of it all. It's the symbolism, the little steelies. You know, you see one and you're like, oh, you know, you walk by somebody with a dead shirt on, you just, hey, cool shirt. You know, no one else knows. It's a cool thing. And now it's a cultural phenomenon. It's part of America. You know, it's part of our history, you know, and that's pretty cool. And you're part of it now. You're archiving
in the canon
and stories that would otherwise be lost. You know, and giving those folks like me an opportunity to tell their truths and their experiences and bring it all together. And like Belle said, in the canon of the Grateful Dead, you know, that's pretty damn cool. You know,
that's how this started. I was trying to remember some stories and I couldn't remember everything. So I thought, well, maybe I'll talk to some people and it'll jog my memory of the things that I did and saw. And
It's a wonderful thing. We watched a couple of your shows. It's a really cool thing that you're doing, and I'm most grateful that I get to do this, and that others, you know, have the same opportunity. So, I mean, if you've been reluctant to be on Will's show, jump in there. It's cool, and I'm sure a lot of people out there got even cooler stories than I do. But I'm just one person in this whole big. You know, millions of people now are, you know, have been to dead shows and have experiences. And I think it's important. So, I'm most grateful for you allowing us to talk about the chimps and our work that we do now and how it's intertwined all the way historically back to the beginning. I mean, I can remember my first Dead albums back when I was like 16, 17 years old. I had New Riders albums actually first because I was I was a little bit more into that, the Birds and that kind of thing. So the New Riders appealed to me in a way that I didn't understand the Grateful Dead because, ooh, Grateful Dead, what does that mean? Ooh, you know. But then I heard Working Man's Dead. And actually the Skull and Roses album and, you know, Bear's Choice is one of my favorites, actually.
That's a great one.
So, and I have all the albums and all the, you know, like I said, paraphernalia. I got hats and shirts and posters. And
all the stuff.
All of that stuff, you know. Yeah. But but it's a good thing. And I'm actually proud to say that I'm a Deadhead. And and I think.
Don't regret a minute of it.
No, Mike Bell said, we don't regret a minute of it. And it's a real honor to be on your show because I think you're doing a service for a lot of folks that have a lot to say that don't otherwise have a place to do it. You know, so
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And thank you, Bob, for taking the time out of your day and Bell for joining in. I really appreciate both of you joining in and telling your story.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm on Facebook and Instagram and all that stuff. If you guys want to know more about our work with the animals, you know, please feel free to contact me. I've even had like Scott Guberman, who had plays with Phil. He wrote to me once and said, oh, my God, I saw your movie. Holy cow. I've had people that wrote to me that are now on the board of directors of animal sanctuaries that wrote to me and went, how do I get to do that? And so I've helped them along the way. Turns out one of them was a Deadhead. And the first thing he wrote to me in the email was, hey, man, you make Deadheads look really good. And I laughed at that. But, you know, most Deadheads that I know are out there doing good stuff, doing good work, you know, adding to their community and doing important other than being Deadheads. They're doing really important work that I think that bodes well for our community, because I think that, you know, you have to participate, and Deadheads certainly participate. You know?
Oh yeah, no doubt.
So anyway, thanks a lot, Will. I appreciate it. And feel free to contact anytime.
All right. Thank you, Bob. All right.
Hey now, do you have a great story about a Grateful Dead show you were at? I'd love to hear it and maybe have you on the podcast. Send me an email at will@talesfromthelot.org and let me know what show you would like to talk about and what made it so special to you.